You've heard a number of different themes, and so I'm going to tell you, basically what happens next, and it's not always a clean process from how we get to journals, to PR, and then PR to the public. But I hopefully can build on some of the themes that you've heard. And so Xiaoqing told you about the importance of making it easy for journalists, and I'll tell you why that's so important, because we don't always get it right. There's a number of pressures that we face, and we might have a little bit of fun at my craft, but hopefully there'll be some topics that I can give you for discussion. So so I was a microbiologist here at UW, so I participated in writing some journal articles. Then when I was at Newsday, we covered a number of journal articles extensively for our readers. And now I actually do some writing for the front of the book for some journals where you have sort of like the news magazine content. That's a more recent development as well, so we'll talk a little bit about that. But basically I wanted to tell you a little bit about why this is a messy process. And part of it is that deciphering journals is really hard. It's an acquired skill, and we don't always get it right. And there's a lot of pressure. So we talked a little bit about kind of the shrinking news holes. You may have a 800-word story that is then slashed to 400 words because there's a car crash, or something to do with Lindsay Lohan, or I mean, this is the truth. So you have this shrinking news hole. You also have shrinking staff. I'm going to show you a slide a little bit later that kind of spells it out, the way that traditional news media has shrunk as journals have increased. And there's also the matter of time. There's a premium now on being first, and first isn't always best. So there are pressures there. And so I'm going to give you three examples that I like to call the good, the bad, and the ugly. It gives you a sense of, here's your article, here's how it came out the other end of the grinder. So this is a Scientific Journal article, duodenal infusion of donor feces for recurrent Clostridium difficile. So this is the first graphic slide, I warned you, right? And in the popular press, and this was actually a really good article, this was From Me to Poo to You, the fecal transplants fighting C. difficile. Now, the reason I bring this up is this was actually, this is a topic that's near and dear to my heart as a microbiologist, but this was actually a landmark study. And basically, Clostridium difficile is a horrible infection in hospitals, kills tens of thousands of people in the US every year. And this is a group out of the Netherlands. This appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine and showed a phenomenal success rate with fecal transplants. In fact, so successful that they stopped the study early because it would have been unethical to continue. Okay, so this is a story that actually got it right. So you can have some fun with the headlines. And by the way, the headlines are almost invariably written by an editor, not the writer, so just to keep that in mind. But the article itself had multiple sources. It had sort of the necessary caveats of what this technique is good for, what it's not good for. They had a little bit of fun with the headline as well. But the main point was that this is a transplant. It's quite effective. Now contrast this with a number of other articles that came out about this study, similar studies, and the first line of one was literally, hold your nose and don't spit out your coffee. Okay. So, priming your reader to be disgusted before you even tell the significance of what they're reading is a good way to kind of shut down, sort of the learning process. Okay. So that's one example. But this particular one came out of the UK. I thought it was a pretty good example. This is the bad. So this was the scientific journal article, glycemic instability and spontaneous energy intake association with knowledge-based work. Out of the other end of the grinder, it became, thinking can make you fat, study says. So, obviously a little misleading. You want a little bit more context here. This is a paper that came out of Quebec, and they had a 14 students, so free labor. But they basically had a battery of different tests. So one, you would sit for 45 minutes. For another trial, they would do reading and then writing summary. And the third would be a battery of mentally taxing work, so it would be computerized tests. And at the end of those 45 minutes, the subjects that did the more mentally taxing work were hungry. So they, basically it was actually an interesting study where the take home was that mentally taxing work or knowledge-based work isn't necessarily accounted for just by expended calories. Okay. So the idea is that when you're considering energy intake and output, this adds a new wrinkle. This article, however, had one single source, no outside comments to put this in context or to kind of look at the benefits and some of the caveats. And the idea that intellectual work alone makes you fat, obviously there's the other element there where there's less activity. Okay. So context is important, and that's something that we often lose as journalists. If we don't have enough space, we don't have enough time, we're not talking to enough people. So the idea of peer review is also a really important one for journalists as well. And now we're going to get to kind of the what I like to call the booby prize, which is just the ugly. And this was a scientific journal, Cured Meat, Vegetables, and Bean Curd Foods in Relation to Childhood Acute Leukemia Risk, a population-based case control study. Out the other end was bacon gives kids cancer. Okay, so this was a 2009 paper out of Taiwan, Taiwan and US researchers, questionnaire of 145 children and the families. These were children with leukemia. First, they looked at all cured and smoked fish and meats, not just bacon. And they also did rule out the effects of environment, genetics, other particular contributors. There was no information on portion size or preparation. So one lesson is correlation does not equal causation. Right? This article was 85 words. It's not clear if there were any sources. And I have to credit actually Popular Science because they had this is as basically a list of misleading headlines, and the author who looked into this really couldn't find any clear attribution at all for some of the quotes in the story. One of which said, "The team from Taiwan said we found an increased risk." End quote, and it wasn't clear if that was actually a real quote. So, another thing, and not to belabor this, but they also got the statistics wrong. So the paper used an odds ratio, and whoever wrote this had confused that with relative risk. So, there were all kinds of wrong packed into 85 words. Okay, so this is maybe an extreme example of how this can go off the rails. But the important thing is, it's not just studies like this. When we're dealing with, evolution, climate change, you name it, the inability to get context right or to not have enough voices in an article can really change the meaning in a dramatic fashion and I think create a whole lot of misinterpretations or misimpressions among the public. So this is a little bit about how we can give scientists indigestion, but I would argue that also works the other way. And one of the things that reporters love to hate is the embargo for the journals. And I'm not going to belabor this, but I'm going to give you some pros and cons, and this has been an ongoing discussion. But the pro is that the idea is that this really
the existence of the embargo gives reporters more time to get it right. Okay, at least in theory, this is how it should work, right? So usually you have a week or so. And when I was at Newsday, we had a schedule. So one of my roles at Newsday was basically to sit down with the editors and say, okay, what's coming for the next week? Okay, we have TNES, we have Nature, we have Science, so what's Monday for Tuesday, what's Wednesday for Thursday, what's Thursday for Friday? Okay, so we would go through this and plan out the week. So that gives you, theoretically, time for science writers to try and have peer review by other experts. And it also addresses the idea that the first to report is not always the best. Okay, so first out of the gate may not be the most accurate. So the idea that you're leveling the playing field a little bit, and so you would allow better reporting to rise up to the top. Now, the con is that publications hate artificial deadlines that are sort of dictating when we can begin serving sausages for public consumption. And they assume that everyone's going to obey the rules, which we know isn't always the case. So how do you reward or punish people who are abiding by an embargo or not? And is there really a consistent way that journals are doing this? And I would argue that it's not consistent. And also, you know, if you find out about a story that's completely independent of a journal embargo, are you still bound by it? You know, if you hear about it at a conference or from a researcher, and do all your reporting, and then lo and behold, embargo comes out. So these are still some issues that we're grappling with. And you know, on top of this, I would argue that we have a lot of, as Xiaojing mentioned, there are a lot of pressures right now on newsrooms. You know, you may have heard that the industry is going through some changes. And what that means is that there's very limited bandwidth to keep up with more than a very select number of journals there. Okay, so at Newsday, we really only had like 6 to 8 that we were capable of following on a regular basis. And so what that means is inevitably a few are going to dominate the news coverage. Okay. So New England Journal of Medicine, JNCI, JAMA, BMJ, Lancet, Science, Nature, PNAS, Cell. Those are pretty much it. And that's with a fully staffed newsroom. So, you know, when I was there, we had 6 to 8 reporters, depending on how you count them, for science, health, medicine. When I left, there was 2. Now there's 1. Okay, so that gives you a sense of the decline in traditional media. So basically what that means is that this increases the importance even more on people who can communicate effectively from the standpoint of a journal, from of the scientist getting the message out there. Okay, because often we're overwhelmed. And basically, just to echo the point earlier, out of sight really is out of mind for us. If you can have the best sausage or you can have the best raw material, but if we don't know about it, it doesn't exist. Okay. So, and this is, I think, just to drive that point home, from one of the posters that Glenn and his team have put together. You now have something like 30,000 journals and climbing from the Pew Research Center had a study that came out. Newspaper journalists are now below 40,000. And this is the first time since 1978 that's been this low. So 30% off the peak in 2000. The trend is continuing now. So we'll get into kind of the rise of online media, but basically the idea is that there really is increasing difficulty for traditional media to keep up with the sheer number of raw materials, so you're going to have to pick and choose.
So that is that's the state of traditional media. Now, there is some good news in that for freelancers, and I'm a freelancer now, diversity is good. Often because we're competing with writers who may be on staff, who may have, you know, be going through the same list of journals that I used to go through as a staff writer. Now, as a freelancer, you want diversity, you want something that stands out, you want something unique that other people may not have. And just to give you an example, when I was doing some writing for MSNBC.com, I had a weekly gig with them, and because they were getting so much material from other sources, I ended up going to a lot of European journals that were not being covered by the US and got some great material there for some of the science stories that I was doing. Okay, so writers will go to other journals, but again, they have to know that they exist. And again, so that's why having someone who's very good at kind of, you know, hand-holding a little bit and say, see, this is here, this is why it's important, this is part of your beat, can really make the difference. And another thing is the idea of or the importance of photos. At MSNBC.com, I got paid extra if I was able to put together an online sort of slideshow, basically. A lot of times, that will also dictate where you appear. If you have a great photo in the newspaper, you always get better play than if you didn't. And it's amazing to me how many researchers and research institutions don't understand that. That visual, a strong visual element that's not necessarily a headshot of the researcher is really, really important. And even now, it's amazing to me, you know, how many people do not get that. But that is so, having a strong visual element is so important to selling a story. So I want to emphasize that. Another thing is access. So we heard a little bit about some of the difficulties with access. And this is another thing that journalists struggle with all the time. You will have some portals like Eureka Alert that gives you access to journals. You have other ones like the Nature News, expanding the family of journals. And but if you have a journal that falls outside of that, getting access can be really difficult, and not all of us have access to like UW Health Sciences library. So a lot of times, that's, you know, unfortunately, that's something else that we depend a lot on, either through each other or through a PR contact who, you know, can say, here, I can send you a PDF of that. You know, in desperation, we'll try and find the PR contact for the journal itself and try and get access that way. Now, the nature of the journals themselves are kind of changing as well, and I like to call it the journal as charcuterie, because you now not only have the raw material, but you also have the finished product in the same place, okay? So you have front of the book, back of the book. And this is a growing trend that we're seeing more. So Science and Nature have front of the book almost like news magazines. PNAS now has one. You have specialty journals. I write for one called Cancer Psychopathology that started doing this on a bi-monthly basis. It's now monthly. This is a trend that's going to continue. And it's a, you know, it's a slightly different audience. This isn't necessarily for public consumption. You have, depending on the specialization of the journal, you can have a different target audience. But it's another way to get interesting stories out there. And so I think this is a really interesting and important trend. But there are also some issues with it. And one of them is conflict of interest, or perceived conflict of interest. And that's been a huge issue in journalism circles now. And the idea is, you know, is there really a firewall between the front and the back sections of some of these journals? Should there be? And if I am writing for the front of the store, the front of the book,
can I then go and pitch something out of the back to another outlet? Where am I double dipping in the charcuterie? And so that's something that is actually a really big unresolved issue right now. And I would argue that transparency, is sort of the best way to deal with this. But there's a lot of friction between kind of old journalism and new journalism, the realization that there aren't a lot of staff jobs left. And so many of us that are out there are now freelancers. And to make ends meet, you have to write for a variety of outlets. And if one of the growing sources is some of these front of the book magazines and journals, that's what freelancers are going to write. Okay, so that's another unresolved issue. But that also brings up the idea of quality control. Another graphic of this warranty, right? Sometimes it's not edible. And we're seeing this with a there's an axiom where you can have your job done well, cheaply, or quickly. And you can pick two. Okay? And we saw that a lot online, and I don't want to just pick on online writing. But there are a lot of wonderful blogs out there. There's a lot of really awful writing as well. And a lot of story mills that, frankly, you pay someone next to nothing and they will turn out a story, which is essentially a rewritten press release. Okay. And so that's really raised the issue of who should be the gatekeepers. We heard earlier about the idea of gatekeepers for scientific data, but we're having the same debate in science journalism. Who should be the gatekeepers for quality? And there's a democratization, I think, of news out there so that they have a lot, many more outlets that exist online. But how do you direct readers to what's a quality outlet, what's a reliable one, and one which is giving you misinformation, which is giving you headlines that are misleading or completely wrong? And I don't think that that's something that we've been able to resolve yet. So that's really sort of an ongoing debate now. And so basically, gosh, I guess I covered most of it. But I'm going to end with a sort of a note of optimism, and that is, I think, despite all the big changes in science journalism, there is reason for optimism because you have a lot of outlets, publications that have kind of figured it out. So, a number of new ones. Matter is one of them. You have long-form narrative journalism, 8,000 words, in some cases. Just won a major science writing award. There's others popping up. Nautilus, we heard about. Aeon, I write for one called Encia, which is environmental news. The Verge, Mosaic. So these are a number of these new publications, and a lot of them have funding from nonprofit groups. Some of them are loosely associated with universities. So we have a different models out there now of how to make some of these publications sustainable, but also reward quality over quantity. And I think that is definitely a trend that should be encouraged. So I've run through a lot of ideas here, and hopefully there's time for questions. But a lot to think about, and hopefully I haven't given you too much indigestion.
Aspect. And this isn't to cast aspersions on that side of the fence by any means. But if you look at the BBC and their coverage of news, it's much more ecumenical. You know, you get a lot of things on the physical side. Is it your perception that in America there is a preference for selling public health? Or, I mean, the journals you mentioned are certainly mostly in that category.
What's that? Yeah, short answer, yes.
Thank you.
You're right. And part of it is that physics can be really hard to explain. And, you know, it requires the ability to, you know, if not read journal articles, then be able to you know, take the time to talk to the researchers that, you know, have them walk you through what they're doing. I think you do have with the diversity of some of the publications now, perhaps more of a glimmer of interest in physical sciences as well, with some of these new publications online, and Matter, for example. At Newsday, we were by a DOE lab, so there was some interest there, kind of because of the approximation. But I agree. I think there is undoubtedly a bias for biological sciences, health-based sciences, and what that means, unfortunately, is that if you are a physics institute, that you're going to have to work a lot harder to get your message out. Yeah, so the way that the embargo works for journalists is that we'll typically get an email from the journal, and they'll say, here's information that's embargoed, and they'll give you an exact date and time that this can be released. And so the idea is that you can have access to the journal article in advance, and it'll give you contact information for the main scientists, or the main couple scientists involved. And you typically have somewhere around, they'll give you like a week in advance notice. That they'll basically be, they'll say, this is embargoed until 2 p.m. on Thursday. So if you release it before then you're punished, and in some cases, you lose access for 3 months, something like that. You're basically dropped from that. Now, that's not consistent with every journal, but that's essentially how it works for us.
So the quality issue you mentioned seems very important. How do you, as a journalist, decide when the quality is insufficient to report in your 3 examples you gave?
I mean, when the quality is insufficient from the actual journal article, or okay. It's a judgment call, right? You know, and we don't always get it right, and so, then there's a lot of times when, journals don't necessarily get it right, with the cloning scandal from South Korea, for example, where it sort of fooled everyone. But I think, it tends to be, in part based on personal preference, because my background's in microbiology, I'll probably be more inclined to write about biological sciences, than physical sciences, unfortunately. I think that's also the importance of what we do in peer review. So not just talking to a scientist who has written the article, but can you identify other people in the field who can say, yeah, this is really good, or it's crap. In some cases, there actually have been times where I started in an article and I've talked with an editor, we said, getting a bad feeling about this. So, so it does happen when we will drop something if it turns out that there's nothing new there, or we're a little unsure about the science. But ultimately
like with the Nature family of journals, they have what we call the JV system, you know, where you have, you know, this sort of pantheon of Nature, you know, something else, Nature, so, you know, with the idea that then it'll work out to just, you know, Nature itself. There are some ruling deadlines where they'll basically, you know, especially for some of these online journals, where they'll say, okay, this one, you know, we're releasing on this date. So they'll do like a selective release throughout the week instead of saying, okay, we're gonna give you all 10 of these articles, you know, right now, go, you have a week to do it. So, but as to whether those are tiered according to importance, you know, I can't.
I just wonder if it made a difference to you, because it used to mean that if it got accepted in PNAS, it would be embargoed. And it would warrant, from our organization, a press release. Then if it's released early online, it's...
I don't think, from my point of view, an embargo doesn't really have any sort of correlation with the importance of it. I mean, I think, you know, you may have 10 to 12 in a publication. The people who work in the press office of the publication may do like a short write-up of one or two of those. So these are like the suggested ones that are, you know, are better than others. But they'll embargo a lot of times all of them at once, you know. So sometimes you're kind of steered toward, what the journal or what a press office would like you to cover. But they'll generally have some sort of cue there, you know, that's beyond just kind of when exactly this is embargoed. Does that make sense? Does that answer your question?